Shrink Wrap Radio number 592, Growing Your Resilience with Dr. Rick Hansen.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Rick Hansen, PhD, who's a clinical psychologist, noted speaker, meditation teacher, and author of a number of books, the latest of which is his 2018 Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. For more information about Dr. Rick Hansen, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Rick Hansen, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, I'm very happy to be here. Please call me Rick, of course.
Okay. And I'm really glad to have you on the show again. We last spoke back in 2010, which is hard for me to believe. It still seems very fresh in my mind. And that was when your book, Buddha's Brain, came out.
Right.
A great title and a really good title. And now 8 years later, we're going to talk about your new 2018 book, Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. That's a tall order,
yeah.
But I'm sure we'll deliver here. And I was interested to see that you have a co-author on this one. Mm-hmm. And turns out it's your son,
yeah,
Forrest Hansen. Uh-huh. How old is he, if I may ask?
He's 30, which 30. Amazes me as a father that it's been
I know
this
how
long.
You feel. I've got some older adult kids myself. Yeah. And I looked him up on the web because I was trying to figure out, well, is this his son or his brother or his father? Who is this? And
yeah.
He's already a very accomplished young man, I must say. You must be so proud. And he's kind of following in your footsteps, I think. Not exactly, but in terms of heart and soul, it's all there.
Well, thank you for saying that. And that's one of the most endearing things a person, of course, could say to me as a dad, just that my kids are turning out okay. And definitely, he's a very talented writer. He was really good for me because every so often, I suspect you can relate to it as a therapist yourself, I would use some sort of sentence or phrase or word that just seemed so obvious to me. Sort of like, well, you know, impulse control or something. Yeah. And he would say, oh, no. You need to unpack that. You need to make that really clear. And I must admit as well, I would occasionally use language that really had deep roots in my hippie days, and he would just cringe enormously. Like, oh, no. You need a more modern way of putting that one, Dad.
Oh, and that's very helpful.
Benefits as well. So, no, he was great to work with.
Yeah, I've got deep roots into hippie days myself, and my wife always catches me in ordinary speech. Either I'm talking too professorly or too hippily. So, and as I read through the acknowledgments in your book, it reads like a whole who's who of positive psychology.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if you've seen any changes in the positive psychology movement, because you're pretty firmly in that. Since it was launched by Martin Seligman back in 1998, so have there been any twists and turns along the way? Has positive psychology, is it mutating at all?
Well, so I think first we should be clear what we mean by positive psychology. And if you look back roughly at the last 100-year history of clinical psychology, so let's mark it with Freud as a kind of fuzzy beginning. And then we had on the heels of that, evolving psychodynamic approaches, maybe even dropping Jung in that tree as his own certain branch. And then along comes behaviorism, and then along comes the human potential movement, humanistic psychology in the 50s. Maslow, Rogers, others like that. And that focus certainly with humanistic psychology was very positive. It was about more than from like -10 to 0. but it focused as well on self-actualization, as you know, 0 to +10. And also there was an interest in really important beneficial experiences, including positive, wholesome, good experiences between a client and a therapist. So there was no shortage of positivity in the humanistic psychology developments in the 50s, followed by the human potential movement in the 60s and 70s. So I don't think Dr. Seligman, who has made enormous contributions, would claim that he somehow invented positive psychology. And also I should add that there's been a lot of research as well on humanistic psychology, positive states of mind, and so on.
I'm really glad to hear you say all of that, because initially, really, he gave no credit to humanistic psychology. And I have deep roots in that whole period myself. And that was something that kind of offended me and other people who were involved in that movement and experienced. Because, in fact, humanistic psychology was a rebellion against the pathological emphasis of psychoanalysis and the mechanistic approach of behaviorism. Everything's kind of blended and softened these days, I think. Those boundaries aren't quite as hardly drawn as they were back then.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And it strikes me as ironic that a profession such as psychotherapy broadly that is very interested usually in history and development. I have a near master's in developmental psychology, and I think of the proverb, right, as the twig inclines, so doth the tree grow, or as the sapling inclines, so doth the tree grow. So how do we incline? It's interesting that a profession that is attentive to history is kind of amnesic when it comes to its own history. And, you know, there is a tendency, I'm going to steer clear of naming names, of just slapping old wine in new bottles with a fancy label and then putting on a white lab coat and saying, "Woohoo, look at me, I invented this." And no, not really. So all that said, in the current territory, which, Seligman and others have really propelled research and, frankly, a kind of legitimization of this field.
Yep, I credit him with that.
Maybe I'll try to be succinct here and say there are two things in particular recently that I think are developing that I want to finally get to your question specifically. One is, much as I think positive psychology was a reaction to the mechanisticness and pathologizing, if you will, of behaviorism and even the cognitive, developments too, in terms of cognitive therapy. Then what happened was that there was a counter move of kind of professional Grinches endlessly raining on the parade of happiness. Why is happiness good? The pitfalls in happiness and so forth. I find that really interesting. Like, why is that? It's as if people are saying, if you're not miserable, you're not really paying attention. And I think that's kind of foolish. That said, I'm hoping that there's a corrective to that doubt about the value of emotionally rewarding, meaningful states of being to grow trait resources inside as well. And I'm hoping that more and more people are really appreciating the incredible power for physical health, longevity, everyday functioning, recovery from trauma, resilience, coping, self-reliance, and happiness of emotionally positive experiences altogether. So I'm hoping there's more of an appreciation for that. And then the other thing that's very much in my own personal wheelhouse and related to the book, there is a lot of attention in the broad territory, let's call it, of positive psychology. And there's a lot of attention in related areas like mindfulness training, self-compassion training, coaching, character development. There's a lot of focus on two things: identifying your inner resources and using them. Great. Really important. But there's been a startling omission of a third thing, which is really, really important, which is how do we acquire these inner resources in the first place? How do we actually become grateful, compassionate, gritty? How do we become securely attached? How do we develop executive functions? How do we become happier, wiser, stronger people? And the how of acquisition, of learning inner resources, not simply identifying them or using them, but really acquiring them in the first place, is, I hope, a growing focus, because that's where the great opportunity is.
Yeah.
We're pretty well developed around, you know, identifying your resources, activating them and using them. But how do you grow them? And that's where I think there's a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, clearly, because you've just really given a lot of the gist of your book here. And I also wanted to mention, before we move on, that I attended a presentation you gave at TEDx Marin about 2 years ago, and you did a fabulous job there. So just let you know that. Before we go further, since your book is titled Resilient, and I'll hold it up so that people on video
beautiful.
Can
I like
see
that.
It. And I like the image of a tree because it implies, and the tree had the leaves look like they're being maybe stripped by the wind. And you were talking about the sapling being shaped. And so here's a tree that's been shaped in a certain way. And the title is Resilient. So I'm trusting
and
that tree
fruit,
is going to.
And the fruit is being offered. So the wind is blowing, but the tree is strong. That's what we tried to do. A little high concept. And those golden green balls there are the kind of the offerings of the tree of a person who's
still. A lot of thought went into this image then.
Maybe too much, but anyway.
No, well, it communicates, it gets there. So we're going to be talking about resilience, and before we go any further, I probably should ask you to define resilience.
Okay. Resilience is simply the capability in a person to recover from adversity and to keep pursuing goals in the face of challenges. So resilience is for certainly surviving the worst day of your life. But much more broadly and importantly, it's about thriving every day of your life. And I think a meaning of resilience has crept in that is overly narrow. It is certainly relevant to people coming back from the battlefields of the Middle East or the battlefields of the inner cities or difficult conditions or the battlefields of your own family upbringing, let's say. There's a place for that. But more generally, if we are to have any kind of lasting well-being in a changing world, a challenging world, we require resilience. So resilience feeds well-being, and wonderfully, as we'll get into it, the internalization of experiences of well-being grows resilience. So the two can support each other in an upward spiral.
Yeah, you made reference to these challenging times, and I wanted to ask you, is there something about this time that we're living in that demands resilience more than in the past, or does it just seem that way?
I think it does demand more resilience than many times in the past, and it does certainly seem and feel that way. I mean, on the one hand, as you well know, there in the developed and developing parts of the world, there are many wonderful developments, growing middle class, growing respect to the rights of women, you know, lifting people out of horrible poverty with many significant exceptions, rule of law, blah, blah. On the other hand, I think for many people, there's a sense of a combination of things. One, the rate of change is accelerating, which stresses us, bombards us, and causes us to switch roles and switch tasks and manage a tremendous amount of stimulation and work long hours, interestingly. That's happening. While at the same time, many, many kinds of social networks that used to buffer people from challenge and were more kind of like externalized resource systems that helped people deal with the rate of change and disasters and difficulty, community, extended family, and frankly, a government that seemed like it actually worked, including at the federal level. And so those supports have fallen away. And then most recently, I think without picking political sides, I mean, it's hard to not deny that there's a sense of things getting unglued or the wheels coming off in terms of what, if only just a few years ago, were well-functioning institutions, especially in the legislative and especially executive branch of the federal government in the U.S. And we see as well a kind of concerted attack by authoritarian forces often tapping into racism and the ugliest forms of tribalism that we saw in the wars of the 20th century are somehow coming back again.
Not just in this country, but in the whole
attack what holds civil societies together. So all that's kind of alarming, and I think that netted out, there's a sense of the cavalry not coming. So we're on our own. It kind of goes to self-reliance. And
of course, we see those same forces and changes happening in Europe, and in our relationships with other governments seems like we're in a particularly difficult place.
So if I could make a point from it, often people set up this false dichotomy between personal growth and social growth, or, you know, improving the world, improving oneself. And of course they go together. For people to stand together and stand up together and speak out together, which I think is more important than ever now, it really helps to be resilient inside. Because then if you grow resources inside yourself, as you become calmer, stronger, more confident, more able to connect with others, more skillful, then you're more able to take action that will help the world become better.
Yeah. You point out that there, as we try to make things better, there are three primary places that we can intervene, if you will. One is our world. Another that you refer to is our body. And a third one is our mind. And you suggest that it's really in our minds where we have the most leverage. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I would say that because I'm a therapist. And I think it's true, and it's not either or. I mean, sometimes you can do things out in the world that are sort of a quick fix. You know, you can tighten down a faucet that's dripping at night and keeping you awake, or you can avoid a person, let's say, that's just nothing but a wrangle to interact with. And so sometimes we can act quickly. But any kind of significant challenge in the world, it's hard to change it quickly. And meanwhile, we certainly can bring attention to where our mind dwells and help it dwell in places that are authentically beneficial, usually enjoyable, if not enjoyable, at least meaningful and useful. We can help ourselves do that. And then based on where our mind is dwelling, where our attention is resting, we can interact with the contents of consciousness in ways that are skillful. We can disengage from what's painful and harmful. And we can, in particular, my focus, engage content in the mind that's beneficial in such a way to help it leave lasting traces behind in the nervous system. In other words, so that we receive it into ourselves, filling ourselves up along the way and gaining durable, lasting inner resources rather than merely a passing experience.
Now, you're talking about inner resources, and you refer to that a lot. Give us some examples of what you mean by inner resources.
Classically, grit, gratitude, compassion, confidence, know-how, secure attachment, impulse control, self-regulation, knowledge of others, knowledge of oneself, of a whole host of factors that have been well identified in the psychological research of the last 100 years, as well as well known in the humanities and in religions, folk tales. You know, I go back to being a Boy Scout, and I only remember 4 of the 12 virtues: thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. That's 5, actually. So, you know, or in Buddhism, I kind of root, you know, training for contemplative practice, the so-called paramis or perfections, which include generosity, effort, factors of awakening, like investigation or tranquility or mindfulness, whatever they might be. Or I think of routinely just dealing with the world where you realize, oh, if I approach an email like this, it's going to be more successful. Or, oh, rewinding that interaction I had with that person at work, I'm going to try to be a little more skillful in this way going forward, right? These are all the inner resources, the capabilities, the virtues, the intention, the attitudes.
Yeah, human qualities.
That makes such a difference.
Human qualities that we all possess in varying degrees, right?
Yeah, strengths.
Strengths, right. Another topic relevant here is plasticity, and the plasticity of our brain's been widely written and spoken about, and I think the general population is fairly familiar now with that concept. Mm-hmm. But you used a phrase that I had not run into before, which is positive neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
So what are you getting at there?
Oh, sure. So plasticity is the capacity of a system to change. So neuroplasticity, as you know, is the functional property of the nervous system that is designed to be changed by the information flowing through it, including that information, which is the basis for our experiences. So our thoughts, our feelings, our intentions, and so forth, our experiences can leave lasting physical traces behind. Positive neuroplasticity is a focus on traces left behind that are beneficial. And implicit in the phrase positive neuroplasticity is the notion that we can do things ourselves using our minds to engage neural factors. We can do things ourselves that increase the capacity of the nervous system positively to gain from our experiences, and we can do things with specific experiences to hardwire them especially into the nervous system. I did not coin the term. It's a general purpose term. And I certainly, you know, draw upon it and think of my work as rested in that framework.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does this jibe with something else that is out there and that you've written about, which is the negative bias of our brains?
Well, that's great. This is one of the most useful findings from neuroscience, and I think we all have an experience of it. You know, you go through your day or you're at work and 50 things happen and one is irritating. Well, which one do you think about when you're falling asleep? Right? And so there's a lot of evidence that the brain is, as I put it, like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones.
And, I love that phrase.
Yeah. And it's true. And the reason for it is very designed in Mother Nature. It's a well-established scientific finding that the brain has this negativity bias, because that's what kept our ancestors alive in harsh, lethal, brutal conditions. Jump first, ask later. Once burned, twice shy. You have to get carrots like food, but if you miss a carrot today, you'll have a chance of one tomorrow. But if you're a little lizard 300 million years ago, or a mammal 200 million years ago, or a monkey 40 million years ago, or a Stone Age human 100,000 years ago, if you miss that carrot, boom, that predator, that aggression in your band, whack, no more, you know, pardon me, if you miss that stick, if you fail to deal with that threat, no more carrots forever. So we have a brain now that focuses on, you know, bad news and takes it in immediately. And meanwhile, beneficial experiences, like a moment of accomplishing something or a moment of relief or recognizing beauty or feeling close to another person or realizing something inside your own mind, whoop, those beneficial experiences pass through us like water through a sieve. Well, meanwhile, the negative ones are caught.
I think there's a real paradox right now for many of us. You talk about the bad news out there. Probably regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, you read the paper and there's a lot of unsettling stuff, or you pay attention to other media out there and there's a lot of really upsetting stuff. And I struggle at this point, and I know I have a number of friends who also have said that they've kind of closed down to reading the newspaper. They don't want to read the newspaper anymore. They don't like to watch the news because it's too unsettling, and they want to be in the positive space. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about how, you know, on the one hand, we feel a responsibility, speaking for myself. Well, I can't close myself off from the world, the real world. I have a responsibility to be an actor there. That's one voice. The other voice is, but how much of an actor can I be? I'm just an individual person.
Right.
You know, so there's
I think that's an age-old question. My own personal opinion is I want to be informed. Also, personally, I'm extremely interested in what's happening. I feel like we're living in the middle of what will be an historically really important period, including, frankly, what we're learning about the attack by a hostile foreign power on the foundations of our democracy in the West, through from Russian intelligence services, which then are taken advantage of and cheerled and cheered on by people that we thought were loyal patriots. Like, what? So I've the problem, though, is that that history book or that Tom Clancy thriller is written a sentence a day. So we only get a sentence a day, and it's really quite fascinating, but unfortunately, it's just a sentence a day. So anyway, for myself, I'm interested in it, but you're exactly right. I think it's easy to get flooded by it. And then the question becomes how to know just enough while at the same time doing what you can. And action binds anxiety. As you know, action is a major corrective to learned helplessness. I think the forces of, I was going to say darkness, but I'm trying to move away from that sort of metaphor language. You know, the forces of, I'll call it evil loosely, they want people to be disheartened and defeated and give up. Mm. And I think it's really important always to reclaim that agency for ourselves, to speak truth to power and, you know, stand up.
I've been in a men's group for a number of years, and one of the members of my group was very disheartened some years back and really spiraling down into depression, and he would talk about that, share that in the group. And then at some point, he became politically active, decided to, you know, you say action is the, counterpoint. Yeah. To anxiety and depression. He became politically active locally, got into elected office, and began to exercise leadership skills that which he seems to have in abundance. And it's really totally turned him around. Of course, there's still things that he finds very upsetting, but just the fact that he's doing things that are positive, trying to move the world in a more positive direction. It's made a big difference in his life.
That's right.
And I know that you've been a meditation teacher, so these questions I'm asking you, I think, are probably particularly important for you. And a key component of the meditation and of the Buddhist philosophy is compassion.
Yeah.
And so, due to your work and that of others, compassion is becoming a major concept in psychology. Now, when I think back to when I was in graduate school in the doctoral program, which for me was in the mid-60s, I don't think I ever came across the word compassion, not in psychology. No research on compassion. And now, compassion has become such a big topic, at least in our corner of psychology. And you say compassion is the first step on the path to growing our resilience. So take us through that.
Oh, thank you for saying that. And you're right to embed what you brought up earlier about how do we deal with political news, with, you know, how do we stay engaged without being overwhelmed? There's a very related notion in Buddhism about the integration or the balance of compassion and equanimity. How do you open your heart wide to the whole world without being flooded by it? And on the other hand, how do you stay calm and centered without becoming apathetic or disengaged, right? How do you bring them both together? So that's a major, 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 major theme.
And we're involved in balancing acts, right?
Yeah.
All these things we have to balance. Go ahead.
I'm very interested in intersections. It's funny. Like, I live on the edge of wilderness, on the edge of open space. That's an intersection. Another intersection is where life emerged, probably on this planet. But, you know, where the land met the sea, or where volcanic vents met the ocean, deep inside the ocean. And in the same way, we live in a time in which are these wonderful intersections of East and West, technology and spirit. And anyway, so I think those are really quite valuable, including the intersection of compassion and equanimity. So, sidebar, With regard to why is compassion first, I go back, I guess, to Rabbi Hillel, that profound saying he had, if you're not for yourself, who will be? And if not now, when? In other words, as you've probably encountered, as I've encountered a lot as a therapist, the very first step is for people to get on their own side. You know the joke, how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change.
Yeah, right.
And, right, that motivation, that sense of caring about one's own pain and wanting to do something about it is really fundamental. If it's already in place, great. And for many people, it's not in place. So it's the very first step of all, a sense of that you matter, that you're for yourself, including a sensitivity to your own suffering and a benevolence and an inclination that becomes increasingly muscular to do something about it if you can. So we have to start somewhere. The book's about these 12 strengths, and we do them in a sequence, although people can jump around. So what's the first one? For me, it's compassion, especially compassion directed internally, because then on that basis, a person will be moved to act in such a way, in ways that are good for them, including ways that will grow more resources inside.
Yeah. Interesting. You're focusing on self-compassion. And, yeah. You know, I said I had never encountered anything about compassion in graduate school. Well, self-compassion is an even later step, I think.
Yeah.
And I did have the privilege of interviewing Kristen Neff sometime mm-hmm. back, and she's kind of really helped to put self-compassion on the map, although I assume it was on the Buddhist map for a long time.
Yeah, and I think it's like we said earlier about developments in, say, positive psychology, often in our own way, we will authentically discover something for ourselves. And then as we explore it, we realize that something equivalent or very similar has been developed and talked about in a whole other tradition we didn't know about. So I think that's true in terms of a sense of self-compassion. And I think it's also true that implicit in certain things in psychology, like the interactions between parents and children that can develop secure attachment on both sides, there is some notion that as children internalize compassion or internalize nurturance or healthy regulation of emotion or impulse, then there is an internalization of those introjects, to use that old psychoanalytic term. And then that becomes the foundation of being able to do that for oneself. So implicit in that certainly is the child internalizing the soothing, the caring, the love, the compassion sometimes of a caregiver, and then being able to do it for oneself. But you're absolutely right. Until Kristen did her first studies on this around 15 years ago, there was no study on this very powerful internal mental resource of self-compassion, which, by the way, makes people tougher. Makes them more resilient, makes them stronger, including reducing the likelihood of PTSD after a combat tour. So
there's research showing that it has these very tangible, real-world benefits.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I know as therapists, we've sort of been cheerleaders for people, letting them know that they're too hard on themselves, and variations of that. And I know for a long time, before I ever heard about self-compassion or compassion, where was it? I'm losing my thought now. It seemed there's a phrase that I've lost here, but
yeah, you'll edit it, and we're fine. Yeah,
the idea that somehow people were not caring for themselves sufficiently. Mm-hmm. It'll probably come back to me at some point.
Yeah.
Speaking of Buddhist concepts, mindfulness, of course, is another one that has kind of exploded on the landscape these days.
Yeah.
But I get a sense reading you that you use mindfulness in a sort of a distinctive way in terms of what you would have us be mindful of.
Well, that's interesting. Well, let's see. So first, as of course you well know, no tradition has a monopoly on any human virtue. So, and nor did they invent it. Buddhism did not invent compassion or self-compassion or mindfulness. That said, you're certainly right. As someone myself who's very interested in the teachings of the Buddha, which are almost all utterly psychological and very sympathetic to a modern Western pragmatic empirical view. Sure. I find a lot of wisdom there. And in the original notion of mindfulness, it's simply sustained present moment awareness, period. And that sustained present moment awareness, which is easy to do for half a breath, but for five breaths in a row or 10, it's not so easy. So sustained present moment awareness, which can be applied externally and internally, and it can be fanned out very wide or narrowed down to a laser-like point. That's the essence of mindfulness. And alongside that, mindfulness can be and usually are other factors, such as self-compassion or curiosity or bring on board some practical knowledge of how to deal with the interaction that you're being mindful of, mm-hmm. or how to deal with the emotional reactions inside yourself that you're mindful of. The problem is, briefly, in modern parlance, inadvertently, mindfulness has become reduced to and narrowed to and conflated with only an utterly passive, inert witnessing of the stream of consciousness, such that many people mistakenly argue that any form of active effort in the mind is somehow anti-mindfulness or against mindfulness. And that's totally not true. I mean, I've had numerous people come up to me after I talk about releasing painful emotions or thoughts that make you crazy, or I've talked about growing the good inside oneself. They say, well, that's not mindfulness. And I think that's not an accurate understanding of mindfulness. Yeah. Other things can be present alongside mindfulness.
Yeah.
We can be active with what we're mindful about.
Right. And so that's the thing I was referring to, your unique spin on it, at least in terms of this book, is that we become mindful of the good occasions in our life, our good experiences, and instead of just kind of brushing them off as trivial or letting them run through us. I think of it as like in dream work. I say, if you don't write your dream down, it's like smoke, and it just kind of disappears. And
oh, that's
you're
very
unlikely
good.
You're unlikely to remember it later on.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And a couple things. So first, my own take on mindfulness is utterly consistent with the take on mindfulness you find in the early writings of the Buddhist tradition. The closest approximation we have to what the Buddha actually thought and taught. Which has a strong emphasis on purification and cultivation alongside a very strong emphasis on sustained real-time mindfulness and increasingly granular mindfulness on scales of time and space. You're more and more able to tune into very subtle nuances in experience or what's happening around you, as well as ones that are very quick and fleeting. So that's true. But you're getting at... And to build on that, you're getting at something exactly right. If we don't sustain attention to our beneficial experiences, they usually leave no lasting benefit behind. We don't learn from them. There's no durable healing or change of any kind. We don't acquire greater capabilities. We don't acquire, as you know, procedural learning, like know-how, including social learning of different kinds. So, it's really important, and for me, that's where I have a lot of focus because it's so often overlooked. It's very important to engage the second necessary step in the neuropsychology of learning, with the first step being the activation of some mental neural pattern. Great, now you're having the experience. But the second necessary step for learning is the consolidation of that encoded pattern of activation into a physical change in our neural networks of structure or function. And without that physical change, by definition, there's no basis for memory. There's no basis
for
memory.
And that comes through a kind of rehearsal of the experience,
it's one way,
right?
Yeah, So what I'm interested in is, what are the factors that maximize the impact of that second stage of learning, the internalization stage of learning, and especially factors that are internal, because those are the ones under volitional control. Like, as you said, extending the experience or engaging different ways of relating to it, such as journaling after a dream. Or we can imagine something we want to internalize and rehearse it, as you said. Mm-hmm. These are all various techniques. They're great. And I didn't invent the techniques. They're all over the place, but they're rarely brought together in any kind of comprehensive and sustained way, such that a person themselves, over the course of a breath or two or three, in other words, over a dozen or two dozen seconds, what can a person do themselves inside their minds to maximize the lasting beneficial impact of an experience? And to be clear, many of those experiences that we want to internalize are not particularly pleasurable. They're not unpleasant usually, but they're not like good experiences. They're a sense of how to be a little more skillful with your spouse or your teenager, or how to kind of lean away from a rumination or a resentment or a quarrel in your mind and instead move on to the next useful thing. Those are the kind of skills we can acquire. We might rest our attention on, you know, a sense of remorse that's healthy about how we acted with somebody, and we take it on board. No, I'm never going to do that again. So for me, the real focus is pragmatic. What would be beneficial to grow inside a person? And then the way to grow it is in two necessary steps. Experience whatever you want to grow, and then internalize it. Help it leave lasting traces behind. It's brutally simple. It's wonderfully simple. Whatever you want to grow, you want to be happier, you want to be loving, you want to be more mindful, you want to be calmer, you want to be more willing to just go for it in politics, why not? Well, you have to experience that. And then once you're experiencing that new thought or sensation or emotion or attitude or intention, you must take it in to receive it into yourself for any kind of lasting value. I find it's really haunting, David, as a therapist, how often I've skipped over that second step.
Well, it's interesting because we both have roots in what was called the human growth potential movement. Yeah. And yet the way you're talking about growth now, it wasn't talked in quite those terms.
I think
with time,
it's
like fine wine, you know. I think it's
it's kind of an idea whose time has come.
Yeah, and it's kind of ripened.
I think the great teachers and therapists and coaches and kindergarten teachers, all of them, use these mental factors in the second stage of learning with their students or patients or clients or, you know, friends or employees, and various therapies that are more somatically oriented or interpersonally oriented tend naturally to engage these mental factors of neuroplastic change, because that's what we're talking about. How do you maximize positive neuroplasticity, right? How do you, I think about those rat studies, right? How do you help yourself be a one trial learner? You know, one trial down, this is the tunnel with the cheese. That's where I'm going to go, right? Yeah. And so implicitly, these methods were present. I think back on all the experiential, intense personal growth workshops I did with people. Yeah, but it is shocking to me how people who are in the growth business have not systematically studied the how of growth, especially the embodied physical hardware basis for growth.
Yeah, of course,
and
we know so much now.
Teach that to other people.
Yeah. We've learned so much about the brain, and the whole neural perspective is kind of coloring and helping to shape our thinking. And I think there was a bit of an answer to the question of one trial learning, going back to those times. And what I would contend is that the magic factor is emotion, or an altered state of consciousness, and those two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. So there were a lot of techniques developed during the human potential movement that were emotionally very powerful. And they might have been like a marathon encounter group, 24-hour encounter group. And that puts you through some very powerful changes that have the potential to re-encode your nervous system in some ways.
That's really true. Yeah. And while I super appreciate those methods, you know, there definitely were some casualties of those methods. And to commit to 24 hours of encounter group with or without your clothes on or things like that is a big ask for people. And what is really striking to me, given that we have a brain in which whose neurons are firing 5 to 50 times a second routinely, and a brain that is very rapid to learn if we help it, what's striking is the opportunity in our lives many, many times a day to take a dozen or two dozen seconds at a time. I say take a breath or two or more, you know, with the experience, to kind of marinate in it, to open to it in your body, to stay with it, to register what's rewarding about it in whatever way is helpful for you. And through engaging these methods, and one is all you need and more the better. And there are others as well I get into the details of for my book and so forth. But the essence is really quite simple. Have it, enjoy it. You know, lately, I've been thinking, David, about this, these two questions. Where does your mind dwell? And what's in your heart? And it's so striking to appreciate that where our mind dwells is what gradually fills our heart. And then what fills our heart shapes where our mind and inclines where our mind dwells. And that cycle is very often spun in negative ways for people. They dwell on negative things, you know, that are beyond what's useful. They dwell in resentment. They dwell in self-criticism. They dwell in anxious rumination beyond the value that would be available there. And that gradually is what fills their heart. Stress and worry and a sense of helplessness, and, brittle, reactive, prickly. On the other hand, the opportunity is to see what's problematic while simultaneously looking for opportunities to dwell in whatever's beneficial. It may not be pleasurable, but it's still beneficial, functional, pragmatically. And then dwelling there, help it become a part of you. So at the end of every day, you're a little stronger, a little wiser, a little more loving, a little happier than when you woke up in the morning. That's our opportunity every day. And I don't care who's in the White House. I don't care who you're living with or sleeping with or who your parent is or who your boss is or what happened in your past. No one can defeat anyone who wants to learn and grow in that way every day.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Coming back to my real world a little bit, given all your work on mindfulness, I'm curious if you ever experience absent-mindedness that seems to come with age. For example, I've poured orange juice on my oatmeal instead of in the glass. I've put lunch meat in the freezer instead of in the lunch meat drawer.
Yeah.
So is it possible to be skilled in mindfulness and still be absent-minded?
I think so. And, you know, as we age, and I'm in my 60s now, like what, as we age, you're right. There are these normal losses in a sense of executive function. You're describing a loss of, you know, metacognition, self-awareness. And I know what you're talking about myself. Sometimes that is an early sign of a progression into significant cognitive decline. It's worth paying attention to. And it's just a real deep, just kind of detail here. I'm a mental health person. That said, there's new interest in things that people can do, particularly related to reducing inflammation in the body that can help protect the brain against cognitive decline, including dementia. That said, one of the best ways, I think, to deal with these kind of losses of executive function of metacognition is to practice mindfulness, especially those aspects of mindfulness that are about concentration, it's called, steadiness of mind, where we just say, nope, I'm going to pick a stimulus object, a word, a body sensation, like the sensation of breathing at the upper lip, maybe an emotion like compassion, and I'm just going to lock onto it. I'm going to dwell there muscularly. And that's my practice. And so if it's like you're either lifting the weight in the gym or you're whining about it. You know, you're either locked onto the object of attention, like the sensations of breathing, or you're off and you come back. And that focus on steadiness of mind is the traditional first step before going into open awareness, which is now, unfortunately, classically taught as the beginning. Well, I think it's better to focus on steadiness of mind, especially in our ADD kind of culture, as a bit of a corrective there. Hmm. But that training in steadiness of mind is a detail, like staying with the sensations of each breath for 10 in a row, and then trying to do 9 more 10s, 10 10s, 100 breaths in a row. It's a serious achievement to be able to do that, including counting them as you go. You know, that kind of training in concentration, I think, can help as we age.
Okay. You say there are three basic needs: safety, satisfaction, and connection. And I liked your discussion of the red zone, the green zone versus the red zone when it comes to getting our needs met.
Yeah.
Tell us about the green zone and the red zone.
Sure. Well, like we were saying, there are these fundamental ideas in psychology that I think the field sort of drifts away from and then suddenly rediscovers, but it's a really traditional idea. Meeting of needs is very grounded in our biology. Animals need to meet their needs. And if you think about it, resilience is what enables us to meet our needs, and well-being is the result of the experience in the moment of a sufficiency. It doesn't need to be perfect, but there needs to be an adequacy of needs being met. So understanding our needs is useful in part because it gives us a framework in which we can identify the key psychological resources that would be usefully matched to particular needs. So a classic model that others have used as well, and I've kind of developed it, is the notion that we need to be safe, satisfied, and connected. These are umbrella terms. And that's achieved broadly through avoiding harms for safety, approaching rewards for satisfaction, and attaching to others for connection. These, again, are fairly familiar ideas in psychology. So now we have these three overarching motivational regulatory processes occurring in our body, headquartered in the brain, that avoid harms, approach rewards, and attach to others. We don't have a choice about that. We also don't have a choice about the ways in which how those systems operate are shaped by the three-stage evolution of the brain with its reptilian brainstem, mammalian subcortex, primate human neocortex, loosely related to safety, satisfaction, and connection. Or as I put it, we all have inside ourselves a little inner lizard, mouse, and monkey. We don't have a choice about that. Our only choice is how we go about meeting our needs. Do we meet our needs on the basis of a sense of deficit and disturbance, something missing, something wrong, triggering an alarm, a stress response, fight, flight, freeze? Do we be safe through fear and anger? Do we be satisfied through frustration, disappointment, addiction, and drivenness? Do we be connected through borderline forms of object relations, insecure attachment, clinging, domination, us against them, tribalism? Right? Or do we meet our needs for safety on the basis of an internal sense of calm strength and capable coping and a kind of relaxation in our core?
That'd be the green zone. And the other one's the red zone.
So that's the first thing. Thanks. Red zone, problematic, useful in the short term sometimes, that burst of stress, but not Mother Nature's plan as a way of life. Even though it's become one for so many people, chronic mild to moderate stress, uneasiness, tension, frustration, irritation. Flip the other way, though, it's remarkable to appreciate that stressors do not need to equal stress. Whoa. Just because there's a challenge doesn't mean we need to deal with it from the red zone. We can actually deal, like I was saying, with safety threats or physical pain. Feeling really resourced with calm strength, same with satisfaction. We could feel really resourced with a sense of contentment already, gratitude, gladness, accomplishment, and lots of know-how, including how to aspire without getting attached to the results. And we can deal with relationship challenges with a sense of of kindness and assertiveness already present inside ourselves, and a quality of lovingness and forgiveness already inside ourselves as we speak truth to power and deal with issues with other people.
We haven't used the word choice, but choice underlies what you're talking about here. And mindfulness is, the trick is to be mindful enough to realize that you're at a moment of choice.
That's really true. And also to build up resources inside so that you're naturally more able to deal with stressors with an internal sense of shock absorbers and resourcefulness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've known a number of people who are very mindful of how they are being hijacked in real time. Well, that's better than being mindless, about being hijacked and upset and inflamed and enraged and alarmed in real time. But that's not enough. To me, what's so important is to grow resources inside ourselves so that when the stressor or challenge lands, it doesn't trigger us in our core. Maybe around the edges of the mind, there's a sense of exasperation or worry or hurt. But in our core, we're sustaining a sense of internal well-being, grounded in peace, contentment, and love in terms of those three needs. And that makes all the difference in the world. Or can we recover really rapidly? Let's say you're mindful of being hijacked. Set the stopwatch. Tick, 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 tick. How long does it take you to come back to center and to feel a fundamental well-being in your core? So me, to finish, I work backwards from reverse engineering people who seem to be highly resilient, even saintly, or people like Nelson Mandela, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who seem to sustain grace under fire in such a wonderful way. They put their political opponents out of the halls of power, but they did not put them out of their heart. Really a critical distinction. What can we learn from how those people are? Yeah. What can we learn ourselves for the factors we can get going and strengthen inside our own brains?
Mm-hmm. That would speak to the value of reading biographies.
Some people read lots of biographies.
And it inspires them to develop those qualities or find them in themselves.
That's right. And when we are inspired or informed, helping it sink in, helping it land. Mm-hmm. Experiencing is not learning. And something I just keep observing is how often we sort of assume that some kind of mud will stick to the walls of the mind.
Yeah.
And yet it's humbling and haunting, really, David, isn't it, to appreciate what a small fraction of momentarily beneficial experiences in ourselves or our clients actually had any lasting, durable value. Hmm. It's haunting to me and humbling.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to do something about it in myself and in my offerings to the world.
Well, that kind of brings me to think of gratitude, which is something you write about as very important in the process. And it seems like the practice of a gratitude journal, for example, is doing just what you're saying as a way of sort of getting the good mud to stick to the walls.
Yeah. I think you're right. The journaling sustains engagement. You know, one of a lot of the factors of learning, especially social emotional learning that we really care about, a lot of those factors have to do with sustaining an experience. Journaling does that implicitly, automatically. And many of these factors have to do with embodiment, feeling. So you don't just write about intellectually, I know conceptually that electrical lights exist. Or I know conceptually that there is water in my glass. Great. But I need to feel something really for it to have maximum impact. So you're right. I think journaling, for example, can help people feel it and help it sink in. And that said, I think a lot of people they are good at activating states of gratitude, but they don't focus enough on acquiring the trait of gratitude. To move from state to trait. That's that second critically important stage of growth and learning. And it's the one that matters, because then it's about what you have with you wherever you go, because states are vulnerable to disruption.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit more, the being in the state of gratitude and moving it into the trait of gratitude.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing to be able to think about things you're grateful for and then have experiences of gratitude. Like being able to do that is good.
Yeah.
Great. But to be grateful, you have to expend deliberate effort, which carries a bit of a cost. You have to be deliberate about it, and it's effortful. And if you didn't do it, you're not grateful, right? That's the vulnerability of states. They're good. They are the first of the two stages of learning. We always have to start with a state, but a state alone is not learning. And we tend to chase state after state after state. Nice in the moment, but that's very vulnerable to disruption if whatever is creating state to state to state changes. On the other hand, if we learn in the broadest sense, emotional learning, implicit learning, somatic learning, procedural learning, etc., if we learn, let's say, gratitude, that means we're moving from state to trait. We're acquiring the trait of gratitude.
Sure.
Much as, let's say, a child could have experiences of being loved by a caregiver. That's the first necessary step of growth and the acquisition, let's say, of secure attachment. But those experiences of being loved or attuned to or responded to or from a caregiver in some ways must lead to lasting change inside. Otherwise, there's no acquisition over time of the trait of secure attachment.
Yeah.
So it's analogous to that. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
And I think that that transition from state to trait is under our nose all day long. And it is both a wonderful opportunity to give yourself the extra breath or two or three with the experience, the state, which will naturally tend to hardwire it as a trait incrementally over time, bit by bit, synapse by synapse. In the famous saying, neurons that fire together, wire together.
Mm-hmm.
So the longer they fire together, the more they're going to tend to wire together. So it's the good news is that this opportunity is under our nose many, many times a day to register, to receive, you know, to sink into something. On the other hand, it's really humbling to appreciate how often we just skitter on from this state to the next state before this current beneficial state has time to sift down from short-term memory buffers into long-term storage.
Uh-huh. This might be a good place for us to leave it. I mean, that's a powerful thought right there for us to meditate on. There are lots more ideas in your book. I really encourage people to get the book and to work with it and let it sink in. So is there anything more that you'd like to say to kind of wrap things up?
Well, I appreciate it. I would say that this transition from state to trait is, of course, relevant to us as individuals who want to heal and grow and develop inner resources that are trait-based and that activate automatically increasingly over time rather than requiring deliberate effort. I mean, that's the process of growth and change. So it's personally relevant, and as professionals, it's vastly relevant. If we're a coach or a therapist, counselor, educator, mindfulness trainer, whatever, if we care about steepening the average learning curve, the average growth curve, response to intervention of the people we work with, paying attention to the transition from state to trait is so useful. And also teaching people what they can do inside their own minds to maximize their own gain from therapy or coaching or that mindfulness class they're taking or really cross-cultural, multicultural sensitivity training in a corporation, whatever it might be, talking with your partner. If you're in therapy with your David or Rick or some other therapist, learning how to help yourself learn as much as possible from the experiences you're having is a wonderful gift to our clients. So I just kind of offer that point. And maybe I'll, I'll close. You've been kind enough with a quotation from the Buddhist tradition that I think about often. Here it goes. Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good.
All right. All right. Well, this has been good, and I will work to internalize it as much as I can. And so, Rick Hansen, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
This interview left me really impressed by my guest, Dr. Rick Hansen. What became clear to me during our discussion is that he's digested a lot of the historical work in psychotherapy, along with that emerging in humanistic and positive psychology, as well as his years of Buddhist practice and teaching, and then also the latest neuroscience. And out of this mix, he's coming up with his own revisioning of therapy and the growth process. I experienced him as an original thinker who's rethinking a lot of what's gone before and who is articulating a unique synthesis. This latest book, Resilient, is very practical in terms of offering down-to-earth guidance, not only in developing resilience, but in becoming a happier person overall. It steers us toward a more fulfilling life and sense of self without being Pollyannish or filtering reality through rose-colored glasses. He used the word skillful frequently in our interview. That's a very interesting word. It's not a blaming or belittling word. Rather, to me, it suggests endless room to grow, but also demands real effort and practice over time. This is the kind of book that you could read through once to get an overview of the landscape, but then go back over it for a year or more, devoting yourself to becoming skillful in the various domains he covers, such as mindfulness, gratitude, confidence, grit, calm, motivation, learning, intimacy, courage, aspiration, and generosity. Each of these topics has sub-skills, if you will. In fact, I think this would be a wonderful book to go through with your family or a group of friends. It could even be used as part of a class that has an experiential component, providing homework and then discussion about progress, challenges, hurdles, and so on. All this, and it's only about 250 pages long.
Hi, I'm Amy Fellman, longtime listener of Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio is like the best textbook I've ever owned. I've learned so much, I was even inspired to start my own podcast. I recently donated to Dr. Dave to show my gratitude for all the hard work and amazing content that he puts out there for us across the world. I hope that he's able to continue his quest in providing everything we need to know about psychology and just enough to make us dangerous. I encourage you all to do the same. I have to say, it feels really good. Thanks again, Dr. Dave. And for all you listeners out there just like me, bite the bullet and donate.
Thank you, Amy Fellman in Melbourne, Australia. Actually, Amy sent this in some time back, and I later got to meet her and her husband when they were visiting the U.S. They are a delightful couple, and last I heard, Amy was expecting her first child. I need to check in with them. Hey, Amy, if you're listening now, let me know. Meantime, her encouragement for you to donate is as relevant now as it was back then. And I'm happy to report we do have two new donors since last time. Xavier Vasquez and Kerry Den, or Dene, or Dean, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But in any event, I'm grateful that you have signed up once again. And once again, I want to thank today's guest, Dr. Rick Hansen, for discussing his new book, Resilient. It was great to have him back on the show. And next week, my guest will be David Hua, CEO, co-founder of Meadow, a company powering California cannabis with a full software suite for dispensaries. I heard David speak at a technology conference recently, and I thought he'd make an interesting guest. You may know that California has recently legalized recreational marijuana. He's very passionate about this development and can give us an overview on the issues that surround this sometimes controversial development. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.